From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Tibetan Buddhist nun Choying Droma joins us to sing some of the songs that are part of her meditative tradition. Her beautiful singing was discovered by the American guitarist Steve Tibbetts, who recorded her and later overdubbed guitar. They just concluded an American performance tour. She lives in a monastery in Nepal. Also, we meet women's basketball star Cynthia Cooper. She led the Houston Comets to the WNBA championship this year and was voted most valuable player for the third time. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Remedy, the first CD released in the U.S. by the British DJ duo known as Basement Jaxx. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton says he hopes stability will soon return to Indonesia and warned that U.S. relations with Indonesia would suffer if the Indonesian government doesn't stop the violence in East Timor. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Despite the introduction of an international peacekeeping force into East Timor, there are still reports of Indonesian government-backed violence there. Today, President Clinton said that U.S.-Indonesian relations have already been altered, military cooperation has been suspended, and so has military aid.
This is a time of great instability and uncertainty for them. We should stand against those actions which violate human rights and which are wrong, but we should also hope that both stability and humane policies will be returned to Indonesia as soon as possible.
The president pointed out that Indonesia is the world's largest Muslim country and that it is capable of playing an important and positive role in Asia. But he said that will depend on responsible leadership from Indonesia. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The House is preparing to consider a temporary spending bill that will keep the government in operation for the first 3 weeks of October. Although the new fiscal year starts on Friday, Congress has approved only a few of the yearly appropriations needed to keep the government functioning. Much of the spending has been stalled by disputes over funding levels for such things as education and welfare, as well as issues ranging from dairy prices to oil royalties. Linda Tripp is suing the White House and the Pentagon. Tripp alleges that officials tried to ruin her reputation after she went to independent counsel Kenneth Starr with tapes of Monica Lewinsky talking about having an affair with President Clinton. NPR's Peter Overby reports.
Tripp is a Defense Department employee. After the scandal broke, Pentagon officials confirmed to reporters that she had never told the department that she'd had a brush with the law in the 1960s. Tripp contends that the leak violated the Privacy Act. The suit also presents Tripp as a whistleblower who exposed wrongdoing that other government officials were trying to cover up. She argues that federal whistleblower protections apply to her, in fact, that the law required her to take the tapes to Starr. Tripp's lawyer predicts a long period of document discovery and witness depositions. The White House and the Pentagon had no comment. Tripp is also under indictment in Maryland for tape recording phone conversations with Lewinsky without Lewinsky's consent. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 24 points to close at 10,303. Advances led declines by 3-2 in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 776 million shares. This is NPR News. President Clinton announced a new and higher White House estimate of this year's budget surplus today. He said the government is expected to take in $115 billion more than it spends for fiscal 1999. He called on Republicans in Congress to work with the administration to protect Social Security and Medicare while paying down the national debt. The United Auto Workers Union has ratified a new contract with Daimler Chrysler. Jerome Vaughn reports from member station WDET.
UAW members overwhelmingly approved the new four-year deal with Daimler Chrysler. The union says 86% of those voting cast their ballots in favor of the agreement. The contract calls for 3% raises in each of the next 4 years. Workers also receive a $1,350 signing bonus. The union says the average line worker will make an additional $29,000 over the length of the contract. 75,000 Daimler Chrysler workers are covered by the new agreement. Bargaining between the UAW and General Motors is expected to intensify in the next few days now that the pattern has been set with Daimler Chrysler. Wages and outsourcing are expected to be key issues in those talks. Ford will be the last to reach a deal with the auto workers' union. For NPR News, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
A nuclear power company in Connecticut pleaded guilty today to multiple violations of federal safety and clean water laws, agreeing to pay $10 million. Northeast Nuclear Energy Company pleaded guilty to 19 violations of the Atomic Energy Act and 6 violations of the Clean Water Act at 2 of its plants. The utility agreed to pay nearly $7 million in fines and more than $3 million in donations, including a gift to the University of Connecticut to pay for a professorship in ethics. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Choying Droma, is a Tibetan Buddhist nun who lives in a remote monastery in Nepal called Nagi Gompa. As part of her meditative practice, she sings songs that have been part of the tradition for hundreds of years. Her beautiful singing was discovered by the American guitarist and composer Steve Tibbetts. He first heard about her on a visit to Nepal. He recorded her singing alone and with other nuns, and when he got home, he overdubbed guitar and percussion on some of the songs. The results are on the CD, Cho. Last week, as Choying Droma and Steve Tibbetts concluded an American performance tour, they came to our studio. I spoke with Choying Droma about the music she sings and her life as a nun. She was born in Nepal in 1971 to Tibetan parents living in exile. Droma is now trying to build a school for nuns in Nepal to provide basic education and basic medical skills. Before we meet her, let's hear music from her CD with Steve Tibbetts, Cho. Important part of the meditation practices in your nunnery?
It's a practice, definitely, but in terms of meditation, well, we have many different levels of meditation we can go through. Very primary level of meditation to advanced level of meditation where point comes to no meditation. But this practice is a practice where we go through a lot of visualization practice also. Visualization of your own body being offered to the evil spirits. And
your body being offered to the evil spirits?
Yes.
I don't understand.
The essential practice of this is just to realize our own negative emotion as our own biggest enemy and the demon, none other than, like, your own negative emotion is the demon. But when we do it for somebody else who is sick or somebody's dead, and if we feel that there is some evil spirit has blocked them or harming them, what we do is like we go in front and say, okay, here you come, everybody come. I mean, there's anybody who likes blood, just have my blood. Anybody you like my flesh, have my flesh. It's just kind of practicing a selflessness. You know, we are so attached to our body. We attach to ourself, our thought, our wish. Mm. And it's just, people, if they understand, it's essential point of practice is that, understand yourself. But here it says, have everything and enjoy, bring peace.
Before we talk more about your life in the Buddhist nunnery in Kathmandu, I'd love it if you would sing one of the songs.
Sure.
And if before you sing it, you could explain to us how it fits in to the meditation practice.
Mm-hmm. Here, this song is a solo song where we also can sing it with the drums, but I usually like to sing it solo. It's kind of a supplication prayer to our teachers who's been the lineage teachers. So, at the beginning, it starts with Namo Guru. Namo Guru means pay homage to my teacher, where our teachers were considered the most important thing in our life, in spiritual practice. Namo Guru Ne Homen Chu Ye Po Do Na Yum Che She Ra Par Che La So Dai son deb je po la chen je lo chen chen ang par che she wa da cho te mo ni je ngu ro zo po je wa me par lam na ro Ne jagun pong bure wo na Yang da zog be san ge la so vande Ne sen chen hon me te ten na Jambo mrawe sen ge la so vande Ne yagran jang me je wo na Kepa arya de wala so vande Dae son deb je po la chen je lo Kien chen ang par che she wa da Cho tu mo ni je ngu ro zo Po hoi je wa me par nam na rung pai
Oh, that was really beautiful. Now, I imagine that you learned to sing that for purposes of meditation and paying homage to your teacher at the nunnery. And, in the past couple of years, you started performing as well with the help of Steve Tibbetts. And I'm wondering what it's like to take this meditative music and find yourself singing for other people like you're singing for us now. It must be a totally different sense.
In a way, different, yes, but on the other hand, it is always our, depend on our, whatever, whenever we do this, our motivation there or our practice or our visualization is always the same thing. But the difference is the outer environment. We have people looking at us, all hundreds of people down there staring at us. But before I start to sing, I feel that. I feel a little strange. When I think very positively, I feel good that I'm getting a chance to let them hear these sacred songs. But once I started, I'm all in my state, my natural state.
My guest is Ani Choyang Drolma, and she's a Tibetan Buddhist nun who lives in Kathmandu. Her parents are exiles from Tibet who have been living in Nepal since, I guess, the late 1950s. You were how old when you came to the monastery?
I was 13.
And How did you know you wanted to be a nun at the age of 13? That seems so young.
To be honest, when I first became a nun, I really didn't much know about being a nun. But it was just to it was just an excuse to get out of the life which I was living.
What was it about? What was it about the life you were living that you wanted to get away from?
I had a very hard life. I was young, and my family, the financial condition wasn't that great. As being young, being the oldest daughter in the family, I was supposed to do all the housework, cleaning, washing, cooking, and taking care of two younger brothers. And, well, those things were not that really difficult part for me, but the most difficult part for me was my father was a little aggressive man. Very aggressive. Right now I understand that he worked so much. He's a sculptor. He makes Buddhist statues. Whole day he works with the fire and chemical. And by end of the day, he's kind of really, really tired and confused. And very small thing made him really angry. And he used to kind of physically, he used to beat me. And not only that, I didn't see any harmony between my mom and dad also. And not only that, I also saw my mom giving birth to my younger baby brother, which was very, very fearsome. Because my baby brother came in the wrong way. And where our financial condition was not that great to take my mother to a hospital. So we had our baby younger brother born in Nepal, at home. And my father and my father's friend, one lady, and me, three of us were there to help my mother giving birth to the baby. But since it came out the wrong way, it took so long, and my mother was losing a lot of blood. I mean, as a kid, I was seeing everything. I was so afraid that my mother was going to die. I mean, I never could imagine that giving birth to a baby was that kind of tremendous amount of pain and difficulty. Anyway, I saw my father and that other lady putting their hands inside and then pulling out the baby. By the time baby came out, it was dead. But still, my mother was kind of, when my father told her that your baby's dead, my mother said, please don't try to, tell my father that not to cut the
umbilical cord?
Yes. And she wanted to have the baby. My father understood that, and then he gave the baby to my mother. And my mother, what she did was, she tried to clean up the mouth and nose both first, and she started sucking from the mouth and blowing through the nose. Somehow, first the baby had some marks in her neck, neck, and eyes was closed, ears were closed, nose were closed. I mean, it was dead. But after several times she did that, and the baby started moving and cried. It's not only that. And then she had difficulty having the after baby comes out, there's another thing has to come out.
The placenta.
Yeah. So she didn't come out, and she was losing a lot of blood. So finally, we ended up taking her to the hospital. So she survived, but all the process was so fearful.
Did the baby live?
Yes. He's now 19 years old. And it's just the experience which I was going through was too much for me. Because my age and my experience was not balanced.
Is this a kind of typical thing that girls come to the nunnery because a parent beats them or because life?
No, not necessarily all the time.
This was unusual.
Normally most nuns who become nuns, either they're parents' wish,
mm-hmm.
because parents are very religious,
right.
And they want their children to be religious person. And on the other hand, people realize the suffering of being in the worldly activities. Mm-hmm. And they think like renunciation is the best way to accomplish peace. That's how they go to the nunnery. But for me, it was just like, experiencing a lot of things like that. And one day I was like feeling so sad. I had a fear that I have to live a life like my mom's. I grow up, get married. I couldn't have a better example of a man beside my father. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe I will have a husband like him. And then give birth to babies. And that's the limited of the life. I didn't want that life, but I didn't know any alternatives either. So I just talked to my mother about it. And then my mom says, you don't have to live the life if you don't want to. And she just gave me the idea to become a nun.
Well, did a nunnery seem like the only alternative way out?
Yes. When my mom told me that I can become a nun, I said, how I can become a nun? She said, there's a very wonderful teacher nowadays in Boda. That's a place area called Boda. Mm-hmm. Boda Nut, where it has the biggest stupa in the world, I think. And I went to him. I said, I want to take refuge. I want to become a nun. And they all laughed because I was young. I was almost around 10 years old. But finally he accepted me. And I came back home and I told my parents. I said, I'm a nun now. You can't keep me home. You have to let me go to a nunnery. Otherwise, you'll be committing a sin. But somehow our family condition was like that and they didn't have anybody to help them. They still kept me for another 3 years. And was still continuing the same old life I was. And I became a little older. I became more rebellious. Rebellious. I said, I'm going to a nunnery. You can't keep me here. And I, no matter how much my father was, angry or, aggressive, I always told him that you let me go to a nunnery or you kill me.
Wow, that's a strong word.
So I think finally he got fed up with me and then let me go to a nunnery.
My guest is Tibetan Buddhist nun Choying Droma. Her singing is recorded on the CD Cho. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tibetan Buddhist nun Choying Droma. She lives in a monastery in Nepal. Her singing is recorded on a CD called Cho. What's a typical day like for a 13-year-old in a Tibetan Buddhist nunnery?
Well, first of all, I appreciate my father very much. I really thank him for treating me
for treating you harshly.
Yes, I really do.
Because you feel like you found your calling because of that?
Because of that treatment, I felt like I wanted to go somewhere where I found the most greatest, wonderful teacher who he taught me the meaning of life. He taught me to love my parents. At the beginning, I used to hate my father a little bit. I used to have some question like, whether is he really my father? Because I used to compare myself to other children because they, like children who had always had new dresses on New Year and they never had to work. They were never beaten by their parents. They had a lot of toys. I used to love to have, a doll. But I never had one. But still, I never complained to my father. Because in a way, I think I understood the situation maybe, or maybe I didn't dare to ask. But my teacher really, for a couple of years, he let me live really return my whole childhood. I was able to play around. I really was like a child. I was very naughty, I should say.
Doing what?
Well, well, hanging around everywhere, not studying. I was really like a free, like a bird out of cage.
So he must have felt, your teacher must have felt you needed that.
Of course, he's omniscient. He must have understood everything. So, and then slowly he taught me very nice, in a very simple way. Never put me in a kind of a boundary saying that this is you have to do or that is you have to do. But very, very unnoticeably, something which you can experience or feel it, you know, but nothing like this is it, that is it, you know. So, never like a class or anything like that. But slowly, with his blessing, with his compassion, I really started to learn and then started appreciating being a nun, started to understand what are the rules of being a nun, what is the purpose of being a nun.
Could I ask you to sing another song for us?
Sure.
You've brought with you a bell and...
Damaru, we call it.
And that's the drum, the drum.
The drum, mm-hmm. Yes. Jema me me ye shi jeng han do ma ma ser na me be dun do shi ke ja jema le do ma da da me be po lo la chen je la par Se do so ma kun yo ye she dun do jin nyam ba me be ten zo ma da da me be bo lo la chen ye la ba se do so ma je ba me be dun do jin
Choying Droma is a Tibetan Buddhist nun who lives in a monastery in Nepal. She'll be back in the second half of the show. Her CD with the American guitarist Steve Tibbetts is called Cho, and it's on Hannibal Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delacorte Press, publisher of Arms and the Women by Reginald Hill, the new mystery featuring investigators D.L. and Pasco. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Tibetan Buddhist nun Choying Droma. Also, we meet the WNBA star Cynthia Cooper. This year, she was voted Most Valuable Player for the third time. She has a new autobiography. And Ken Tucker reviews the new U.S. release by the English duo Basement Jacks. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tibetan Buddhist nun Choying Droma. She lives in a monastery in Nepal. The American guitarist and composer Steve Tibbetts has recorded her singing songs that are part of her Buddhist tradition. He's overdubbed guitar and percussion on some of the songs. Their CD is called Cho. Now you're a teacher who you were very close to. You were his assistant.
Yes.
From when you were 13 till his death, I guess, in 1996.
Yes, so that was February of 1996.
So that was how many years? About 10? More than 10 years.
More than 10 years. 12, almost 13. Mm-hmm. 12.
Do you wonder what he would have said about you performing?
He would have laughed. Definitely. You crazy, he would tell me.
But you think he would have, you know, accepted it and encouraged you?
I mean,
you to
he
do
was
it?
A positive about it, you know. What
was he alive when you started doing this?
Yeah, we did the recording. I mean, with his permission.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before when first I was more shocked than my teacher was. I mean, when I received his mixing up and everything, when I listened to it,
when you received Steve Tibbetts' version of your songs with his music
yes.
mixed behind
yeah.
it, yeah,
I never expected that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was shocked, really, honestly. I was pretty shocked, and I said, what is this? But when he said, let's make an album, and I wasn't going to decide what I was, I mean, saying yes or no. I definitely went to teacher, and I said, what do you think of making a album? You know, like, it'll be able to reach out to a lot of people. And he was very positive that these sacred prayers are very blessingful. We believe that you can liberate people by letting them hear the sacred songs, you know. So that was the positive thought he gave to me. So I was very positive since that.
Can you give us a sense of what a typical day might be like for you now in the nunnery?
For me?
Yeah.
I'm now more as a staff. I mean, individual practices, of course, that's very necessary in our life. We try to practice as much as possible. But still, I'm not a diligent person. And what I try to do is, try to find what's there happening in the nunnery. Is there anything I can do? Mostly what I do is I see if anybody's sick or anybody needs anything medically. Like, we have 15 nuns and 3-year retreat, and I try to check whether everything is fine with them. If any of them are sick, I go down, because I drive a jeep. I'm the only nun who drives in Nepal. I think probably I'm the only nun who's driving. I'm a rough driver. So I can go down and get a doctor and, you know, understand what doctor says, what's the problem, everything. So that kind of thing I do. And I'm really am on focusing very strongly into my project also, which makes me spend a lot of time.
The project of starting the school.
Exactly.
Yeah. Could you sing one more short song for us?
Sure.
Introduce it for us.
This is a song where you would invite all the evil spirits and tell them that you might have been my parents, since we believe that we have taken many, many rebirths. And so any life, anybody could have been our parents or our child. So it's kind of a life circulation. And I want to repair your kindness. And since many years, since long time, I've been so attached to my body, myself. And that caused me still remain in this world of samsara.
Is that the materialistic world?
Yes, materialistic world, which was so much focused outside. And then our negative emotion ran the life mostly, and which was full of suffering. And let me just clear my depth and bring peace. And with the peace you will receive, I pray that you all take the rebirth in the realm of Buddha. And all the male in the realm of Buddha, all the female be reborn in the realm of Tara. That's a goddess, Tara.
Okay.
That's a prayer, you know, here.
Choying Drolma is a Tibetan Buddhist nun who lives in a monastery in Nepal. Her CD with the American guitarist Steve Tibbetts is called Cho, and it's on Hannibal Records. Coming up, women's basketball star Cynthia Cooper. This is Fresh Air. The Women's National Basketball Association concluded its third season earlier this month. Each of those three seasons, Cynthia Cooper led her team, the Houston Comets, to the championship and was voted the league's most valuable player. Cooper was the first WNBA player to score 1,000 points. She's now 36. Before the WNBA was formed, she played professional basketball in Europe. She played on the U.S. Olympics basketball team in 1988 and 92, winning gold and bronze medals. She'll be back in the Olympics next year. Cooper has a new autobiography called She Got Game. She grew up poor in South Central Los Angeles. I know this was a difficult year for you. You lost your mother from breast cancer, and your good friend Kim Parrott on your team died of brain cancer. Yet you managed to win the MVP for the third year. How did you remain so focused, given all the problems in your life?
Well, my mom always taught me to persevere through the tough times, and I know that Kim and my mom would have wanted me to come out and play hard and play well and help my team win the championship, and that was our goal right from the beginning. You know, my mom got a chance to watch us win two championships while she was alive and watch her daughter and see her daughter win two MVP awards. So that was a blessing in itself. And I know how motivated and how strong Kim was and how hard she fought against the cancer. And she wanted us to fight even harder during the WNBA season to pull out a championship. You know, it was tough. It was very, very, very tough. Some of the toughest days that I've had to go through in my life. But I know they would have wanted me to persevere.
Before the WNBA, you couldn't play professionally in the United States because there wasn't a professional league. So you played in Europe. And it's so odd to me that, you know, since America is so basketball crazy, to think that the Europeans had professional women's basketball before America did makes no sense at all.
Well, that's true. Right after college, the only option we had was to go overseas and play. I just believe that the American public wasn't ready for women's professional basketball. And you know, we still view women as, if it wasn't an individual sport like tennis or golf or track, you know, it was more, you know, team sports, you tomboys, and they didn't really understand how we could be maintain our femininity off the court but be fierce competitors on the court. And that took a little while for the American public to accept. But now, I mean, they've accepted it, and they come out in big numbers to support the WNBA.
Were the teams pretty international in makeup?
Well, you're allowed. We played in Italy. I played in Italy. And you're allowed two foreign players per team, and then the rest are Italian.
Mm-hmm. So what was it like being one of two who weren't Italian on the team?
Well, it was a little lonely at times. It was a little lonely at times. But other times, since I got a chance to learn the language and really learn the culture, live as an Italian in Italy as opposed to trying to live as an American in Italy, it was actually a positive experience for me.
Now, the American Basketball League was starting at about the same time as the Women's National Basketball Association was starting. How did you choose between the two?
Well, it was easy for me. The ABL didn't want me, and the WNBA did. So
I guess that'll do it.
That was pretty simple.
Boy, they made a big mistake, huh?
Well, I think they underestimated the talent of the players overseas, and they really didn't give them a fair chance to come into the ABL, be a part of their league. And the WNBA, they sent scouts over to the to Italy or the different countries to see the talent level of the players over there, and then they were able to make a better decision.
What did the skeptics say when the Women's National Basketball Association started up?
Well, I don't think anyone really believed that it could be successful. I don't think that anyone believed that we would provide an exciting enough style of basketball to win over fans, but they were dead wrong, and I think it started out with the team out in Atlanta, the gold medal winning women's basketball team in Atlanta. You know, it's the excitement around women's basketball started then. But then when we started the WNBA, it was just great to see the fans come out and support us. But eventually, we had to get out on the court and show what we could do. And we got out there, and I think we played great basketball, very, very exciting basketball, and that's why the fans stuck with us.
What's the relationship of the NBA and the WNBA?
Well, the NBA, professionally or organizational-wise, they have really been kind of our big brothers and showed us the ins and outs of the game and showed us how to market the WNBA. The men, the players of the NBA, they've really come out in big numbers and supported us no matter where we go to play, no matter what city we're in. They watch us on television, and they really follow They follow our success. And they also bring their daughters and their families out to watch the games. It's great to see them come out and support us the way they have.
How does the style of play and the rules compare between women's and men's basketball now?
Well, the rules are a little different. We can still play zone in the WNBA, whereas in the NBA, they're mandatory man. The men play 48 minutes. We only play 40 minutes. The ball, we have a smaller ball than the men have. And then other than that, it's pretty much the same.
What about the style of play? How would you say that compares?
Well, the men play more of they rely more on their talent and athleticism, whereas we, the women, we concentrate more on fundamentals and we play more team ball and a lot more team defense, and we really stress defense a lot more than I think the NBA does.
I'm wondering how the size of women players compare to men. I mean, the men in the NBA now, for the most part, are so, like, super tall. Do you think that most of the women in basketball now are as comparatively tall as the men are?
No, we're not as tall as the men. You have one player in the WNBA at 7'2", and then you have a couple 6'4", 6'5", players. But, we're not as tall and as physical as the men.
That must change the nature of the game, too, you know, not being as tall.
Well, no, it changes it in a sense that we don't dunk and we don't, you know, do those type of athletic moves, but... I mean, anybody who's been a part of a WNBA game realizes and understands how we play, what we do, and why our game is so very, very exciting.
So are most of the fans men, women, both?
Most of the fans are women and children. And then you have a lot of men who bring their daughters to the game. But lately, I mean, we've had just anybody and everyone has been a fan. Like, I'll walk down the street and men say, "Oh, girl, you got game." You know, it really proves that they really follow us.
You know, for boys who love basketball, their dream is to play in the NBA. When you were a girl, what was your dream? I mean, there was no women's professional team to play on.
Growing up in Watts, I think my dream was to be successful at whatever I wanted to do. Whatever I ended up doing, I wanted to be the best at it.
Well, and in basketball, though, where did you think that would get you before there was a league to play in?
Well, I didn't start playing basketball until I was 16 years old. My major goal was for me to use sports in order to get my education. So I played softball, I ran track, and once I started playing basketball, I felt like that was going to help me or be a stepping stone for me to further my education and get to where I wanted to be in life.
Well, it did further your education. You got a scholarship to the University of Southern California. And I think you felt like a fish out of water at the beginning there.
I really did. I mean, I was a fish out of water. I was surrounded by rich people, white people that I had never seen in my life. Growing up in Watts, you're kind of surrounded by your environment, and that's it. And the only Caucasians that I saw was on television and or the teachers at my school. And so it was somewhat of a culture shock to be kind of thrown into an environment where you're expected to excel and it be so different than anything that you were used to.
Well, you did well in basketball, but because of academic problems, there was a period when you couldn't play on the team. Was there like an academic average you had to meet in order to stay on the team?
Yes, there is an academic average that you have to meet. And I just had a lot of problems adjusting initially, but I persevered even through those problems, and I hung tough. And with the help of my coaches and friends, I was able to get through that also.
In retrospect, what do you think of that kind of rule? Do you think that your status on the team should be affected by your academic average?
Absolutely. I think academics should always come first, and basketball or whatever sport that you play should come after that. You get a scholarship so that you can go to school and complete your education, not necessarily that you can move on to the next level with whatever professional sport you would like to be in.
Cynthia Cooper, her new autobiography is called She Got Game. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the new CD by the English DJ duo Basement Jacks. This is Fresh Air. The British duo known as Basement Jacks, Simon Ratcliffe and Felix Buxton, became well known for the intense dance party nights in Brixton music clubs where they were DJs. People in England responded to the team's mixture of everything from disco beats to flamenco guitar. Basement Jacks has just released its first full-length CD in America called Remedy. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
The first thing you notice about the music of Basement Jacks is its lightness, its playfulness. So much dance and techno music sounds like notes strung together by a computer, untouched by human consciousness, let alone a sensibility with humor. For this reason, the Jacks sound is positively exhilarating. Listen to a track like Jump and Shout, featuring a vocal by someone named Slarta John. This CD, called Remedy, offers an alternative to current dance music. Real warmth, real melodies, real vocals, all without forsaking the rhythms that keep people moving on the dance floor. Much of the music has the heat and intensity of old Chicago house music from a decade ago or more. Here's the album's first single, called Red Alert. Red Alert! The cut features a vocal by the singer Blue James and owes a debt to George Clinton's P-funkiness, as well as invoking now obscure disco divas such as Gwen McRae and Anita Ward. To paraphrase Anita Ward's biggest hit, the best of Basement Jacks can really ring your bell.
Don't want to stop. I got the time for the present, living on a spinning talk. It's a man.
Felix Buxton and Simon Ratcliffe refer to their music as punk garage, emphasizing its artful slapdash quality. What they've really done is create one of the few CDs that holds up both on the dance floor and in the privacy of your own home. Basement Jaxx's closest stylistic colleagues, the Chemical Brothers, have had their music hijacked by TV commercials and teen television dramas, where the beats have come to signify both hipness and easy alienation. Basement Jaxx is offering, as its album title says, a remedy for this. Listen to them now, before they pop up as the soundtrack to a goopy love scene on Felicity.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Remedy by Basement Jaxx. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music by Aretha Franklin. She has a new autobiography and will be our guest one day next week on Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support from Little Brown & Company. Little Brown & Company, publishers of the Breast Cancer Prevention Diet, the powerful foods, supplements, and drugs that combat breast cancer, by Dr. Bob Arnott, in paperback wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, The Big Test, The Secret History of the American Meritocracy. We talk with Nicholas Lemon about his new book on the history of the SATs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.